Welcome back to the We Rebel podcast.
Oh man, y'all, did you know James is a singer?
I promise you, I really am.
He actually really is. But we should like remix the openings every time and maybe we make songs for our listeners.
That would be kind of cool.
It would set the tone for happiness, even though sometimes we talk about intense things.
We do. And I guess we should warn, is, I don't know, I don't want to call it a trigger warning, but yeah, we are talking about some rather serious topics.
We're talking about the death penalty today.
Yeah. And I know ever since I've been a kid, or at least known that the death penalty existed,
yep,
I kind of had an aversion to it. You know, I was just very, this is just me speaking, that it's kind of weird to think, you know, if someone killed somebody else, that we get to just decide that that person's life gets to end. I'm not sure if I agree with that eye for an eye type thing. So, but that's just my opinion on it. I know many people have their personal feelings about the death penalty, especially when it comes to specific crimes. Like, it affects a lot of people, like the families of the victims of someone that committed a crime, and then that person's going on death row. Like, it affects so many people, yep, besides just that person.
And I think that's what I really learned from, I don't want to say enjoyed, but what I learned from this conversation with our guest Gregory Joseph was, you know, I know what it is, I know how it works, but really understanding the ecosystem in which the death penalty exists, mm-hmm, was really helpful and interesting to hear, not only historical perspective and angles from different parts of it and how much it costs and who pays for it and all these different things. I think he does a really incredible job about giving us that whole picture.
Yeah, absolutely.
Around the actual act, mm-hmm, I suppose.
Yeah.
So he's with us from the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, and we're excited for you all to dig into this topic. Hey everyone, welcome to this week's episode of We Rebel. We are really excited to sit down with Gregory Joseph, who is the Communication and Program Director for the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. Gregory, hi, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me, Emily. It's good to be here.
Of course, we're excited to...
I'm not here, I'm not anywhere near you, but it's good to be on your program, I should say.
The metaphorical here, meeting of the minds. We're really excited to have you because I think that, I mean, I don't want to speak for our listeners, but unless you know someone or are working in the space of, you know, criminal justice, the death penalty doesn't necessarily cross our minds every day. So, and yet it's such a huge issue and defining many people's lives. So I'm curious if you could start us off for our listeners of just a snapshot of where we're at with the death penalty. It was reinstated in 1976, and here we are in 2018. So where are we at?
Well, we are, I guess we can say somewhat at a crossroads.
Okay.
When it comes to the death penalty, we still have states that, you know, use the death penalty and apply it on a regular basis. Places like Texas and Florida and Virginia are very active in the death penalty. But over the last 10 years, we've had states that have done outright repeals of the death penalty, like New Jersey and Maryland. Some states in the country have been experiencing a little difficulty with their death penalty protocols. That is that, you know, a lot of the pharmaceutical companies that have provided the drugs that have been used in executions have become opposed to their drugs being used in this manner. And so they're no longer providing correction departments with these drugs. And so therefore, a lot of states have had to rewrite their protocols. And some of these protocols have actually been proven to be not constitutional. So there have been a lot of moratoriums on the death penalty why states have gone and revised their protocols. So there's a lot of, you know, positive movement with regard to the death penalty. I believe that the American people from a whole have been kind of disillusioned with the death penalty and as being an unjust and unfair and a cruel and unusual punishment. I believe the advent of DNA evidence has brought it into a little more focus that we could possibly be executing an individual who could be innocent, because there's a lot of death row prisoners who are on death row, not for anything besides witness and documentation and not any physical or DNA evidence. And I just think that the overall move across the country to look at all of our aspects of the criminal justice system and to see exactly the examination of where it's not been applied fair and where there's levels of bias have definitely extended to the death penalty as well.
And I'm curious, you know, because we, like Emily mentioned, the Supreme Court ruled in 1976 to reinstate the death penalty. And I feel like it's a very, it's a moral issue and a social conscience issue. So, you know, what, could you talk a little bit about that case? You know, why, you know, what happened and why originally was it taken away? Why was it put back? And have you noticed, you know, the mentality behind a decision back in 1976? Is that kind of, are we kind of on that same train now, or have our thoughts evolved on the death penalty?
Well, I believe our thoughts have evolved. I mean, you've got to put yourself into the shoes of a 1976 individual and coming off the Vietnam War and coming off the protests of the 1960s and early 70s, there was a need or a desire for people to kind of reclaim a law and order perspective in this country. And the death penalty was one of those things that they held out as being a deterrent to crime, so to speak. But we've seen since the federal application of the death penalty that is actually not a deterrent to crime, and we have the evidence and statistics to support that. There are states without the death penalty that have lower crime rates than states that with the death penalty. So the notion of the death penalty being a deterrent to crime has been proven to be a false falsity. With regards to the evolution, I believe that we all have evolved. I believe that we've evolved in our way in thinking about a large number of policy issues, not just with regard to the death penalty, but with regard to the whole totality of the criminal justice system. We believe in second chances. We believe in parole. We are trying actively as a nation to reduce our prison population by looking at decriminalizing certain crimes. Marijuana possession, drug possession, and petty thefts are no longer being held with the same kind of jail time. We're looking to reform bail because there's a lot of people who are sitting in prisons who haven't even been convicted of a crime. They just can't afford the bail to get themselves out. And I believe that as a society, we've become a little more compassionate in understanding exactly what is needed to punish people and how that people can be punished. And we want to be better than other places. And we want to be better than our collective humanity that doesn't rely on a very old, outdated relic of a punishment to say that society is against something what people have done. So I think the evolution of we've evolved in a lot of areas with regards to the death penalty, but we still don't have the number one consensus to say, you know, that we should eradicate it across every 50 state and then our federal system as well.
Right, because according to your website, which for those listening, it's ncadp.org, you have an interactive map, and there are stats listed next to it. And one of the stats is that 19 states and the District of Columbia do not have the death penalty. So that you know, it's still a small number, you know, less than half of the country is without the death penalty at the moment. And, again, going back to the whole moral and socially conscious issue, you know, you hear things about, you know, these mass murderers or, I've even heard people bring it up when in the case of like child molesters. And there's always this there's a bar. Right. And everyone says, oh, well, this person did this crime. They deserve to die. And it's a very I think it's a harrowing judgment to make. To decide to end someone's life. And I kind of want to delve into the psychological aspect of the death penalty, because as you said, it's a relic. It's an old way to execute a punishment. And I feel like there's some aspects not only for the person that is, you know, facing the punishment, but also there are people hired to execute that. There are also family members on the other side of that. So I want to know, what are the psychological aspects of capital punishment in this country?
Well, you know, a death sentence affects a large swath of people, and not just the individuals who are involved in the case. Mm-hmm. Like you said, there are family members on both sides. There are people of faith who are adamantly opposed to death penalty, like members of the Catholic Church, and the Pope had recently come out a little bit over a month ago saying that the Catholic Church is adamantly opposed to death penalty and will apply this opposition to future Catholicism teachings, which was a huge monumental moment for not just the abolition movement, but really for the world, for the Pope, the leader of the Catholic Church, to say unequivocally that the death penalty is wrong, and that in all the teachings of Catholicism, it should be applied. And that was a major, major step in the right direction for the movement. But I mean, you've got a whole bunch of people who are affected by a death sentence. The jurors who reached the verdict, the appeals courts, the lawyers, obviously the family members. It's just, and then, you know, the people like in my jobs, in my profession, the abolitionist community, who never want to see anyone executed. You know, one of the greatest organizations that I've had an opportunity to work with is Murder Victim Families for Reconciliation. And these are organizations, and this is an organization made up of victims, of crime victims, of the families, of those who've been murdered, who don't want to see that ultimate punishment. As you said, you know, there are people who have authority to say we should put that person to death. Well, these are people whose family members were killed in very heinous and disgusting ways. But they, even though that they've lost a loved one and a family member, they've been opposed to the death sentence for the person who is the perpetrator of that crime. And that takes not just a tremendous amount of faith and a tremendous amount of compassion and humanity to not be so vengeful, to say that there is a better part of our collective humanity that can stand and say, this is not a punishment that is just. This is not a punishment that's going to bring back our loved one. It's not a punishment that's going to give us this quote-unquote closure. And it's just killing, it's, you know, it's the same eye for an eye, leaves the world blind knowledge that they're bringing to that. And it's a wonderful organization to be able to work with because they bring that level of, you know, you have a personal level of being personally affected by a crime but still standing up in opposition. And the more and more that we let victim families and we let religious and the faith community stand up and say, and the more we let prosecutors who realize that it's not a deterrent to crime and they realize the bias and the ineffectiveness of it, the more that they stand up, they're going to help us move our collective moral compass in the better and correct direction.
And so you mentioned it's obviously a complicated emotional, social, religious, you know, opinion that each person develops throughout their life. So they get to this point where, the public has their version of their opinion on the death penalty. But looking inside the system of the death penalty and not only the cost, but also before we get to that, which I'd love to, there's also bias that is built into the system. And so can you talk a little bit about specifically the racial bias involved with who ends up on death row, who actually ends up being executed, and the history of that?
Well, you know, there's bias up and down our criminal justice system, and the death penalty is definitely has its share disturbing patterns of bias. You know, from the statistics that we've seen over the last couple of years, we can see that an African-American individual or Hispanic-American or Latino, if they are convicted of killing a white person, they're more times likely to be sentenced to death than as if a white person would kill an African-American or a Latino-American. So we see that people of color have been subjected and been prosecuted and been sentenced to death at a higher rate than white Americans. If the victim is female, if even a white female, the chances, the possibilities, if you're in a death row state and you're a person of color who's been convicted of killing a white female, you're probably going to be sent to death row. There's an inherent bias with regard to the death penalty. It's built into our criminal justice system. It's built in, you know, it's the same thing that we see with, you know, people of color who get pulled over by the cops repeatedly. You see this in police shootings. There's an inherent bias in our criminal justice system that people of color, dark people, are perceived to be a threat, perceived to be dangerous, perceived to be a threat to society, and we lock them up and we throw away the key, and sometimes we execute them at a higher rate than we do white people. And we see the racial, and then we have not only that from the criminal justice perspective, but we also see racial bias when it comes to the juries. You know, because the juries are picked from communities sometimes that don't have, you know, people of color in people of color residing within the community, or people of color who are educated, smart, and active members of the community, and the people of color in some communities just kind of push to the fringes and become that element. So you bring in a racial bias into a jury, and you're automatically kind of starting, you know, you're starting at a disadvantage. You know, we see this all over the country with these police shootings. We see this with this racial violence, whether it's in Charlottesville or whether it was in Washington, D.C. last week. There's racial tension in this country, and so it's not surprising that it gets carried over to our criminal justice system. And, you know, we as a country need to really start examining the way that we think about the way that we're addressing the criminal justice system and the way that we're looking at people, and whether or not that we're unfairly punishing one part of the society heavier than the others. And, you know, the death penalty, you know, I mean, historically the death penalty was a crime that was a punishment that was reserved for people of color. I mean, if you know, back in the Jim Crow days, you know, they wouldn't even have a trial. You would be lynched for talking to a white person, or if you're in the case of Emmett Till, for supposedly whistling at a white person, which never happened. And, you know, they would, the mob justice would just, you know, lynch you, and it wouldn't be a problem, and it wouldn't be nobody would have any moral problem or legal problem with it. So, you know, the death penalty historically has been a punishment that has been heavy-handed and used against people of color. It's never been rid of its racial bias, just like the criminal justice system as a whole has never been rid of its racial bias. And it is a goal and a worthy goal, I think, of all of our nation to work towards kind of a racial harmony and a racial understanding, and to really understand exactly what people of color have been subjected to with regards to the criminal justice system, so they can actually see for themselves exactly how much has been broken on our backs and how we can work to remedy it.
You know, because the more you say that, the more it sounds to me like when the death penalty was reinstated, it was almost kind of like an easy out for, you know, because, you know, I think racial tensions were definitely, you know, they definitely weren't solved by 1976. And so I think it became an easy way to get rid of some people of color. And, you know, I'm not going to say that as a blanket statement, and please no one listening saying like, oh my gosh, he said the death penalty is only for, you know, but what I'm saying is, you know, there are a lot of things institutionalized, whether it be, you know, through policing or death penalty, you know, all the way through our justice system. It does seem like it's an easy way to, you know, because we have overcrowded prisons, it's an easy way to get rid of some of those people in there. You know, it's an easy way for them to like meet quotas. You know, we hear stories about that all the time too. So, you know, I've been very against the death penalty, but since I was a kid, like it's never something that made sense to me, regardless of the crime or the person. It's just who are we to judge and who are we to take a life? You know, I read this interesting quote that you guys have on your website, from one of the books featured. This is from a retired executioner named Jerry Givens, and he says, "You sentence a guy to be executed. You give him a trial, then you send him to me to be put to death. Then later on, you say that this guy was innocent. You didn't put him to death. I did. I performed the execution, so you might suffer a little. I'm going to suffer a lot because I performed the job." So this is not a singular occurrence. There's a lot of issues where we are having people that are innocent put to death, and later on finding out, oh, there was evidence that suggests that it wasn't them, and oh, we're sorry. Like, and that's all we get is an "I'm sorry, we messed up." In these cases where people are put to death and then later on we find out they are innocent, you know, who's held accountable for that? Who is responsible for putting an innocent person to death?
Well, there is no accountability. That's the problem. You know, there has been no, there's nobody who you can point the finger to in these incidences and say that this person is ultimately responsible. And there's a long list of people who are a part of the machinery of death, so to speak, that, you know, can, you know, you can lay responsibility on their feet. You know, there's always a governor who can always, you know, issue a last-minute reprieve. In some states, there's a board of pardons and paroles that hear cases and grant them either a pardon or obviously a parole, who can also stop the death penalty. There are prosecutors and attorney generals who, you know, heed the death penalty and seek this punishment. There are appeals courts that uphold the eventual appeals that come with a death sentence. The jury that, you know, that vote to sentence people to death. And it's in none of them will ever, none of these people who come across the way, even going back to the cops who arrest them, there could be bias in that system, and that person who is innocent sometimes has had nothing to do with the crime. But of course, they've been arrested and tried, and the whole thing is a sham, and they face a death penalty. The case of Troy Anthony Davis comes to mind, a gentleman who was convicted and executed in Savannah, Georgia, executed in the 2000s, but convicted in the late 80s for killing a police officer. Was convicted solely on eyewitness identification. And all these six eyewitnesses have canted their testimony, but the state of Georgia decided to still go ahead and execute someone who everyone believed did not have anything to do with the crime. And nobody in Georgia had felt any sort of reprieve from that. Nobody was felt any pressure. Nobody got elected. Nobody got defeated from office. We just tend to not care if these mistakes happen. It's almost as if we feel like there are mistakes that happen, and, you know, if you want to make a cake, you have to break some eggs, and it's a really horrible way to look at it. But if you think about all the people who have been let off of not just death row, but have been released from prison for DNA evidence has cleared their names, nobody loses their job. There's a gentleman from Florida in the 1950s who was convicted and put on death row for killing his family. He was in jail for 35 years. And when he was released, nobody lost their job. As a matter of fact, people actually got promotions at other elected offices based on his conviction. And as this gentleman is still trying to get money from the state of Florida for his wrongful conviction, and he still hasn't received the full amount of money that he's entitled to for wrongful conviction. But nobody, I mean, look at the Central Park Five. I mean, the one person who advocated for the death penalty for the Central Park Five is sitting in the White House now. There's no account, and those boys were totally innocent of all those crimes. And Donald Trump took out a full-page ad in a newspaper in New York calling for a reinstitution of the death penalty, and these kids should be put to death. And these kids, you know, nobody lost their job, and the person who's actually advocating for the death penalty to be used on these kids is now the President of the United States. So there is no accountability when mistakes are uncovered, when there's bias uncovered, when there's unfairness uncovered. It's just swept under the rug, and it's just like, okay, well, we corrected the mistake before it actually turned into a fatal mistake, but we still have no idea of all the people that we've executed who've been innocent.
So, you know, let's say for a second that we don't have it, that I don't have any morals, and I don't understand anything you just said. People in that mindset traditionally or stereotypically understand the concept of losing money or investing in the wrong area. And so I'm curious to hear from you a little bit more about how much these programs to have the death penalty active cost, and what we could be reinvesting into the root of the problem, which is more around crime and early childhood development and all of those things. Like, how, if we don't understand the social elements or the moral elements, like, we understand profit and loss, you know, so where does that, where is that in this ecosystem?
Right. It's all about the dollars at some point.
Yeah. Right.
If you don't believe you know it's the deterrent to crime, if you don't believe it's biased, if you don't believe it's unfair, then then you would believe that it's expensive.
Yes.
And it is. It costs more to execute someone than it does to put them in prison for the rest of their lives. That's just the hard numbers truth, and there's nobody who can out-argue that. It is cheaper for a state, for a county, for a locality, even for the federal government, to keep somebody in jail for the rest of their lives than to actually execute them. And that's the financial cost. We're not even talking about the emotional, moral cost that's involved. We're talking about pure finances. And you're absolutely right. What we can do instead of spending that money to execute people is that we can find ways to reinvest that money into places where we wouldn't have, and we would be able to lower crime rates. And not just from a criminal justice system, but we can invest in education, not just from an early childhood education, but all through, from, you know, K to 12, you know, and put our dollars into educating, hire better teachers, pay teachers more, offer a wide range of educational opportunities so kids can actually have a constructive basis in education, and then actually make college tuition much more affordable, if not free, so people can have the step up that higher education goes. We can invest that money into job opportunities and create economic opportunities into distressed areas and crime, high crime areas, so people have jobs. If people have a meaningful job and a healthy education and affordable housing and health care, they're not going to be committing crimes. I mean, crime is sometimes it's a means to an end. Sometimes it's a necessity to commit a crime because they're unable to afford the basic life. But if we're able to invest in ways that people can get quality health insurance without spending every last dime, or they can get affordable housing without spending last dime, and there's economic and job opportunities for them, we can reduce crime that way, and then we'll see a reduction in death sentences because we'll see a reduction in crime. And there have been places that have done this. We see that crime drops when jobs come into a neighborhood. If you look at places where there have been large employers that have been plopped down, right now there's a whole bunch of states that are fighting over the new Amazon headquarters. And some of those places that are fighting for them have been really like distressed and high crime areas like Newark, New Jersey. If Newark, New Jersey gets an Amazon center and brings thousands upon thousands of jobs to that area, you're going to see a crime drop. I mean, it is absolutely, you're going to see crime drop, you're going to see better housing, you're going to see better health care, you're going to see a lifting up of a neighborhood that has been distressed and in trouble. So we just take the money that we're spending on the death penalty and invest that in wise and social ways and education ways and health care ways. We're going to see crime rates drop and we're going to see less death sentences. And if we can get politicians to understand that the roots of crime begin at the classroom, and they begin, and like you said, in early childhood development. And if we make investments there, we're going to see which. But they don't believe that. They believe that they need tanks, like they did in Ferguson, or they need more jails, or they need more cops, or they need just to arrest people at will and mandatory minimums and all these ridiculous things that just increase the jail population, but don't really actually address the problem. And we need to address the problem, and the problem is best addressed outside of the criminal justice system and into areas like education and social services.
Absolutely. I wholeheartedly agree with that because that is the root of the problem. And when you go to that first, education, rehabilitation, things like that, that's what solves your problem. So we don't need to have these overcrowded prisons. We don't need to be killing these people. You know, there are so many other ways that we could positively affect our society. So
here's an example. I didn't mean to cut you off, but here's something that is prevalent in New York City. If you are if you're an ex-prisoner, if you're released from jail, you're not by law permitted to live in what we call NYCHA, the New York City Housing Authority housing, apartments that are city subsidized, where a lot of people live. You're not allowed to reside there. So if your family lives in a NYCHA house and you get out of Rikers Island, you get out of Ossining, you cannot go back home to your family. You cannot go back to your family apartment. You also know how hard it is for people who are released from prison to get jobs. Reentry is a huge problem. People, we've been trying to ban what they call the box, the question of whether or not you've been convicted of a crime that happens early in the job interview process, and push it further down the line so people can actually get a sense of who you are and not what you've done. So it's harder to get a job. It's impossible to get to find a place to live. And you've just been released from prison for 8-9 years, and you can't go home to your family, and you can't go get a job. What are you going to do? You're just going to go right back into the life of crime that you have. There's no opportunities, no education, and it's impossible. And this is the cycle that we keep on creating. And again, like you said, it's the root of the problem that we have to address.
Yes, absolutely. So at this point, what can our listeners that have been hearing you this entire episode, what can they do to get involved with the NCADP? You know, what are some events you guys have going on? What are ways that people that are concerned about the death penalty, how can they be active today?
Well, I always tell people the best way to be active is to find out what's going on in your state. So if you live in a death penalty state, if you live in a state where there's death penalty, I would say that you should be looking at the state representatives and the state assembly people who are running for office and hold them accountable for the position on the death penalty. You can find information on some information from a legislative standpoint on our website. There's also the Death Penalty Information Center, which is good. But you know, this is the time that we're coming up to a very interesting time right now where we have elections, and some of these people need to be held accountable for the positions on the death penalty. So you can find out in your state whether or not your state representative or your governor or the district attorney or the attorney general and if they support the death penalty, then you can go to the ballot box and voice that opposition, or you can call their office and voice that opposition. We also have a very interesting Supreme Court nomination coming up here in the next couple of weeks in Washington, D.C., and with a nominee who, you know, has not really ruled on the death penalty, but it has been very disturbing with regards to a lot of criminal justice issues, with regards to bias and fairness and a lot of disturbing rulings with regards to civil rights. Call your United States Senator and tell them to vote no on Brett Kavanaugh. Call your United States Senator and say vote no on Kavanaugh. So call your United States Senator and tell them to vote no on Kavanaugh. That is the first battle that we have coming up right now for the court. And then, you know, you always need to pay attention to what's going on. Abolishing the death penalty is not something that we're going to do on a national level. It's being done on a state level. And every year a state that has a death penalty, there is a piece of legislation that is introduced that sometimes gets a hearing and most of the time doesn't, but it is to abolish the death penalty. Find out the person who's introducing that legislation and then support that individual. Make sure that you call your assembly members and your state senate members and tell them to bring this piece of bill to a hearing or vote for this piece of legislation. Because there's a lot of movement happening in the states, and there's a lot of positive and sometimes negative death penalty legislation that's creeping around. And there's tons of information, tons of ways that you can get involved. But right now, it's the most important thing to do is to use your voice and use your voice to make sure that the Supreme Court doesn't put another pro-capital punishment on it. Make sure that you use your voice and make sure that the governor and attorney general of your state understands that the death penalty is an issue and should be abolished and not used, or just put away and not used again. So that's a great way to get involved. And you can always come to our website, the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, www.ncadp.org. Sign up for our email alerts. You'll get our newsletter once a month. You'll get our email alerts. We do a monthly webinar series where we talk about various aspects of the death penalty. Our next one is on the 31st on this month. We'll be talking to a professor from John Jay Criminal Justice College in New York City about what the Supreme Court nominee means for the abolition movement. And we have a webinar series once a month where we bring in various professionals to talk about all aspects of the death penalty. And follow us on Twitter and Facebook at ncadp.org, at NCADP, where we engage in various conversations and spread a lot of information. And we're going to be, as soon as the legislative session starts kicking back in after the summer recess is over, we're going to be a lot more active and letting people know what legislation is popping in their states, who is running for office, who's been opposed or supportive of the death penalty, who needs your help and who needs your opposition. So follow us on social, sign up for our email alerts, and get involved in your states and find out exactly what's going on. We have affiliate chapters in every state. So if you live in Georgia, go for the Georgia Alternatives to the Death Penalty. If you live in Nebraska, the Nebraska Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. Up in Michigan, I believe it's the Michigan Alternatives to the Death Penalty Organization. We have affiliates who work on the ground in every state, so you can always get involved with them for a localized level. But please just, you know, find a way to get involved. find out what's going on legislatively in your state, find out who's running and who's supportive in opposition of the death penalty, and use your voice. Use your network, use your social media contacts, use the people who you know, and spread the word.
Great. Gregory, what a wonderful call to action, and I think you're dead on at this point.
And listen to ReRebel podcast.
Oh. Yes, there it is.
Listen to the podcast.
Yeah, everybody keep listening. Well, thank you so much for coming on, and thank you for providing all this information. And again, to our listeners, I highly encourage looking at the website, ncadp.org. It's a great aggregation of information, and I think that the recommendation of starting local is excellent, because there's always something to do right outside your front door. So thanks so much for coming on, Gregory, and I think that's a wrap.
Well, the one thing I want to say, and like I mean this in the most positive way, I don't want anyone to lose a job, but Gregory, I hope one day we accomplish this goal so you don't have to keep doing this. It wouldn't
well,
be
I feel the same way. I think I've seen it to all my colleagues in the movement. I tell people all the time, it'd be great if we were all fired, and we wouldn't have to do this anymore, because we know if we're out of a job, then we've done something pretty monumental and historic and what's better for our society. So yes, put me out of work, you know, please put me out of work, and let's abolish the death penalty so I can move on to abolish something else that I don't like.
Yeah. Awesome. I love it.
Yes. Thanks again, Gregory.
No, thank you very much. I had a great time, and thank you for giving this issue a platform and for giving our organization an opportunity to talk to people who really want to join the fight. We take a whole all hands on deck approach to abolishing the death penalty, and you guys are definitely part of the approach.
And absolutely, and I'll end on this note: vote no on Kavanaugh. That's it.
Did y'all know that immigrants and even children and the disabled are not always guaranteed an attorney in immigration court in the U.S.? Well, that's a fact. And one of our friends of the pod from season one, Alana, is here to tell us a little bit more about what the Immigrant Defenders Law Center does.
Hi, my name's Alana Holt. I'm a managing attorney at Immigrant Defenders Law Center, or IMDEF. IMDEF is a nonprofit law firm with the mission of providing legal representation to immigrants facing removal from the United States. IMDEF provides full-scale deportation defense to almost 600 immigrants annually, in addition to legal education classes and training to over 1,300 unaccompanied children in detention each year. IMDEF focuses on representing the most marginalized immigrants in proceedings, including unaccompanied children in immigration detention, as well as adults with mental illness. Our work has also recently expanded to include representation for families who have been separated as a result of the administration's cruel zero-tolerance policies. You can learn more about our work by visiting our website, imdef.org, that's imdef.org, or by finding us on Facebook, Immigrant Defenders Law Center. I think IMDEF's biggest success in the 3 years since our founding has been our ability to evolve, adapt, and fight back against the current administration's unprecedented assault on immigrant communities. For example, IMDEF played a crucial role in responding to the administration's cruel and racist travel ban by dispatching a team of lawyers and volunteers to do work at LAX. IMDEF is currently fighting to ensure the humane treatment and access to critical legal assistance for approximately 1,000 immigrants who, in an unprecedented move by this administration, were recently transferred to a federal prison in Victorville, where they are currently languishing in inhumane conditions without knowing when they'll even be brought to court. IMDEF, again, has also recently expanded our legal representation to include representing families affected by the administration's family separation policy. Those are just a few examples of the countless ways that IMDEF has responded to protect the basic rights of immigrants during this dangerous time. If you want to get involved in IMDEF's work, please visit our website. Again, it's imdef.org, and consider making a donation. On our website, you'll also find a link to a volunteer form if you are interested in providing things like interpretation services or transportation for clients who have recently been released from custody. Also, be sure to look us up on Facebook and like our page so that you can stay up to date on other various calls to action. Thanks so much.
And that's it for this week's episode of We Rebel Podcast. As always, please feel free to contact us if you have any questions for the two of us or our guests at werebelpodcast@gmail.com.
And you can find us on all the social medias at We Rebel Podcast, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
See everybody next week.
Hey everyone, I'm Holly Laurent, and I have a new podcast called Mega. Each week, I'm joined by my two co-hosts, Ross Kimball and Greg Hess. It's a fully improvised podcast existing in a fictional mega church called Twin Hills Community Church. Each week, we have a different comedian on playing a new character who works at the church. You can find us on Campfire Media or wherever you get your podcasts, and I promise you, church is about to get a whole lot funnier.
Campfire.